Hi, and welcome to the Virtual Refuge Sangha podcast. Today we're talking about loving kindness meditation practice. And with me are Kim Sika, Laura Riggs, and Greg Woodhouse. I have no experience that seems to me to point toward a belief in either rebirth, as the Buddha taught, or reincarnation, as other traditions have taught. So I offer the next couple of minutes of introduction to loving kindness practice, a meditation practice, as a non-believer in rebirth. And so instead of believing, try imagining. Imagine for a minute that you do believe in rebirth, or even more, in reincarnation. Imagine for a minute that there's an essential element to existence that is you, your awareness, and your essential identity, but it's taken different shapes and different forms over countless eons. You've experienced the life and the living of a monarch butterfly, as the purest potential of a fertilized egg hanging from the underside of a milkweed leaf in the Bitterroot Mountains of Montana. You've experienced life as the hatched-out tiger-striped larva, aware only of milkweed leaves, sunshine, darkness, and chewing. You've lived the life of being carried back into pupil dormancy by deep patterning of your own DNA, and then of emerging orange and black-winged and flying into the sky, and then following the path built into your mind and body that leads you to migrate to Mexico as the seasons change. And you've lived that same butterfly life 1,000 different times. And every other form of sentient life as well, a bull elk, maybe eaten by wolves. You've been a feral cat in the alleys of San Francisco. You've been a sparrow laying tiny speckled gray eggs in the springtime, a sow nursing 6 piglets, a rattlesnake, a howler monkey, a scarab beetle, a turkey vulture chick, hatched and hungry, maybe a hedgehog even looking for a mate, a coyote with a belly full of blackberries, but still unsatisfied. And you've been 1,000 more beings 1,000 times over, each time experiencing and embodying a different form of life, a different way of living. And then imagine that you've done the same thing as a human as well, over 1,000 eons. You're a mother caring for young children, an autistic man living in a large community, maybe an apprentice blacksmith in the frontier America, a Neanderthal matriarch or a Homo erectus tribesman. You've been a son, a daughter, an aunt, an uncle, a mother, a father, a grandfather, a grandmother. And with all that imagined experience, remember also the experiences of those lives. You've been an enemy to someone, an ally, a lover, a killer, a thief. You've robbed, you've been a pirate, you've been captive. You've starved, you've gorged, you've ignored, you've followed, you've led. You've been famous, you've been unknown, you've been rich, you've been poor, you've been miserable, you've been joyful. And now, for a moment, consider all the people in the area around where you are right now, whether they're your family or your lovers or your associates, or if you're listening to this podcast as you're driving down the road, the other people driving, the other cars around you. Each person around you has been your brother a countless number of times before. Each person in the room has been your adversary. Each has been your grandfather. Each has been your dinner. Each has been your devourer. Each has saved your life. Each has shed your blood. And now imagine all those people and look at them. Each one of them has given birth to you at some point in the past, has wiped your face clean, held a cold washcloth to your fevered forehead. Each has fed you from her breast. Each has protected you from harm. Each has loved you more than herself. And each of those people has done that encumbered by the limitations of evolving anatomies, encumbered by the gates and mazes of DNA-structured instincts, restricted by the language and ethics of a particular culture that they lived in, limited by the availability of food and water and the prevalence of disease. Even if you're a firm disbeliever in rebirth or reincarnation, engage your imagination just for a minute to see the beings around you in that construct that each of them has done for you in other lives all that a person could ever do for your benefit. And if you're able to hold that imagined thought in your heart and mind for a moment, reflect for a minute on the feelings you experience as a result of that thought. Perhaps it's a softening of something you hadn't noticed was hardened. Maybe it's a quiver in your chest or a sense of warmth in your belly. Maybe it's a slight tightening of your throat or maybe a welling of a tear. Or maybe it's just a whisper of gratitude and a sense of appreciation. During the last Dharma talk, we talked about karma and the ways that our minds and bodies respond to our actions, our experiences, and our intentions. We talked about how every experience we have changes us. If you allowed yourself to imagine the rebirth or reincarnation stories I just told you, and if you looked at the people around you and felt even a tiny glimmer of warmth and appreciation and kindness toward them, then your body-mind is now different than it was before you experienced that. That change itself is real, whether you believe in reincarnation or rebirth or what, or whether, like me, you don't find that story plausible at all. The change, the softening, the opening, the appreciation, the kindness, those are all real, whether the story fits our measure of historicity or whether it's an invention exactly at the intersection of my words and your mind. One last consideration before we turn to the main topic today. Consider for a minute the contrary action, hostility, anger, and vengeance. The Buddha taught that allowing ourselves to wish ill upon another person is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to get sick. He taught that it's like taking a red-hot ember and grabbing it as tightly as we can. If we allow ourselves to imagine that for a minute, and to consider what life has been like when we've harbored anger or ill will or hatred for another person, it can have a contrast to the experience of kindness and appreciation. One last thought before we dive right into this. I'd venture that the Buddha wasn't teaching these things because he thought that good was good and evil was evil. He was teaching these principles to his nuns and his monks because for almost everybody, this is part of the path towards awakening, even though it may not seem quite like it. So now let's talk directly about loving-kindness meditation. If you're much like I was when you first learned of the practice, you may find yourself doing a bit of a mental eye roll. You'll find yourself thinking at some point, really? I'm supposed to artificially persuade myself to feel nice toward other people? You may think that this is exactly not the path to awakening into emptiness and nirvana, but maybe something annoyingly and cloyingly like a cupcake frosting. But if you can suspend your disbelief for the stories about rebirth and reincarnation, just see if there's no harm in this. If you find no harm in it, give it a try. Even if you lived a charmed life and been loved and loved by everybody you ever met, this practice will spotlight ways that your mind avoids opening, the ways that your heart clings to desires, and the way that your mind defends its perception of itself. I promise. So without too long of a wind-up, here's the practice. It's repeating again and again and again some short phrases expressing a wish that another person be happy. Really, that's the core of the practice. The traditional phrases that are taught to Vipassana meditators are, may I be happy, may I be at peace, may I live with ease, and may I be free from suffering. May I be happy, may I be at peace, may I live with ease, may I be free from suffering. But there's nothing sacrosanct about the traditional phrases. And to engage in a loving-kindness meditation, I want to suggest to you that you need to choose four phrases that work for you. They can be those four. May I be happy, may I be at peace, may I live with ease, may I be free from suffering. But I'd encourage you to try out different phrases to see which ones best align with your own warmest, most heartfelt wish for another's well-being. Maybe rhythm and cadence matters to the way the phrases feel as you repeat them in your mind. And if so, you may want to fashion them like verses to a poem. And you might feel a little bit of resistance to a particular phrasing or an expression, and so you can change it to alleviate that resistance. And by all means, experiment. If it takes a day or two or five, fine. But work on the phrasing until you find something that works for you. It doesn't have to be perfect, as if there were such a thing. When it comes to loving-kindness meditation phrases, good enough really is good enough. But once you've decided on a set of phrases, stick with them through the first month, yes, month, of practice. Part of the inner power of this practice depends on the consistency of the wording over time. Once the mind knows the phrases by heart, knows them so automatically that it can go on reciting them in the background while you brush your teeth, while you shop for groceries or drive to work, once it knows them that deeply, the mind and the neurons of the brain, I'd venture, will reinforce those pathways of mind, and that will enable some of the benefits of the practice to manifest in your life. So once you have your phrases, there's another step to the practice. And to give you a clear sense of this, let me share with you the phrases that I use, again recognizing that there's no particular magic in them. These are just the phrases that work for me. I start with, may you be healthy. Then I move to, may you be happy. Then I go to, may you be peaceful. Then I go to, may you be clear. May I be healthy. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be clear. That's it. Those are my four phrases. So once you've decided on the phrases, the next step is to apply them to real live people, and this is, of course, the hard part. If you want to give this a try, I recommend that you commit to a length of time, or I guarantee you'll find yourself bailing out early. whether it's 2 minutes or 5 minutes or 20 minutes or whatever, decide in advance how long you're going to do the practice, and then pick a time. You've heard me say this about every meditation practice. Pick a time when you can do it consistently from day to day or week to week, whatever number of repetitions you're able to do it or you're able to commit to. And I will admit this. When I started, I hated the whole idea of loving kindness meditation practice. I really did. So I had to negotiate with myself. Yes, it was a bit awkward, but I managed it out anyway. So I decided to try it out purely as an experiment, and not because I thought it could possibly be anything other than self-delusional, new agey rainbows and unicorns. I really had a nasty attitude toward this. But I wanted to be a true meditator. And this seemed so contrary to what I thought meditation was about. But I, long story short, I didn't want to waste any of my actual life or all Vipassana meditation time on this kind of fluffy stuff. But at the time, I was doing about 20 minutes a day on an elliptical trainer machine. And so I decided to do the practice while I was working out on the machine. Now, I will guarantee this does not lead to optimal results, but it was all I was willing to venture at the time. And we can talk a little bit toward the end about what results came. But 20 minutes a day on an elliptical trainer, not a bad way to start. So according to the traditional instructions for the practice, you start by repeating the phrases slowly and deliberately to yourself. So I would begin by saying in my head, I don't usually do these aloud, but sometimes I do, may I be healthy? May I be happy? May I be peaceful? May I be clear? And when I get to the end, I pause for a moment to allow myself to feel a sense of kindness toward the person, in this case, toward myself. And then I repeat the phrases as I did the first time, again and again and again, for the entire pre-decided length of time, for this decided number of days, for how long? There's no official rule book at all, but I'd recommend that you do it for longer than you think is reasonable. So if you think 5 days is a reasonable period to try this practice, do it for a week. If you think a week is reasonable, do it for two. If you're still finding interesting experiences arising, keep at it until your internal sense tells you to move to the next step. The next step is to start exactly as you began, directing the phrases to yourself. But when you complete the cycle of repeating them for yourself, you then direct them towards somebody for whom you feel undiluted, unalloyed love. Now note, this is not somebody towards whom you feel erotic attraction, but love. You can choose a benefactor, someone who, when you think of them, you think nothing but appreciation for what they've done for you, no wants, no resistance, just loving kindness. Or you can choose somebody for whom you simply feel a sense of warmth and openness whenever you think of them. At any rate, after you've selected that person, whether living or dead, what matters most is the feeling that thinking of that person generates in you. And after you've selected that person, you first direct the phrases toward yourself. Then you repeat them, but direct them towards your benefactor or your loved one. Then you do it towards yourself, then towards your loved one, and so on. I struggled with this one at first, frankly. I struggled finding the right person to direct them to. There's nothing wrong with reaching a point in the practice where you say, well, you know, I'm starting to encounter issues associated with who I've chosen, and so I think I'd be better off choosing a different person for this particular category. It's okay to make those changes if you need to. Just for contrast, I originally chose the first yoga teacher that I worked with, but as I practiced using her as my loved one, it did start to get complicated. Even though she'd moved away years earlier and we'd lost touch, so it wasn't that we had an ongoing relationship of any kind that was troubling, but my feelings got mixed and muddled. And so instead I settled on a particular 3-year-old girl who, when we'd settle into the pews of our church for services, she would jump down from her family's pew, walk back to ours, and just sit beside me for no apparent reason. Just like in Forrest Gump, for no particular reason, this little girl would just come and sit beside me for no particular reason, for several months in a row. And I just found myself feeling a great deal of warmth for her, and so I used her as the loved one. At any rate, you repeat the phrases for yourself and for the loved one for the same period of time you just did for yourself. If it was 2 days, then you do it for 2 days. If it was a week, you do it for a week. Just for reference sake, when I started this practice, I did it for a week at a time. So it was a week for 20 minutes on the elliptical trainer for myself. A week following that was for myself and for a loved one. And so you repeat the phrases, may he be healthy, may he be happy, may he be peaceful, may he be clear than for yourself. May I be healthy. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be clear. And as you might surmise, the next step is to select someone toward whom you feel pretty neutral. Maybe it's someone in your life who doesn't really move your needle one way or the other. Maybe it's someone in your life whom, upon reflection, you mostly ignore, even though you're aware of their existence. Maybe it's someone you don't know at all, but whose life intersects with yours. It's the person who delivers your mail, or gathers your garbage up, or a person who works in your office, but who you only see in the elevator, and maybe you don't even know their name. And for that person, you say to yourself, may he be healthy, may he be happy, may he be peaceful, may he be clear, and then you move to the benefactor, or the loved one, may she be healthy, may she be happy, may she be peaceful, may she be clear, and then, of course, you move to yourself, may I be healthy, may I be happy, may I be peaceful, may I be clear. And you do that for the same period of days or weeks as the first two. Then comes the fourth, and for many of us, the hardest part. You then pick somebody you don't like, someone toward whom you feel animosity and or ill will. The traditional instructions are to pick an enemy, and a caution at this point. As seemingly banal and plain vanilla as this practice sounds when I describe it, or at least it sounds to me when I describe it, when you practice it as I've outlined, it gets down into the roots of the mind pretty fast and pretty deep. So if you've experienced abuse or trauma in your life, don't automatically jump to the idea that you ought to choose your abuser as your adversary or enemy. In fact, I'd recommend that you trust the practice to work even if you choose somebody about whom you feel much less animosity or fear. You can always change the person who embodies your adversary. But whomever you choose, do as before. Direct the phrases first to yourself, then to your loved one, then to your neutral person, then towards your adversary, and then repeat the cycle starting with yourself again. And then do that for the same period of time that you did each of the first three stages in the practice. That's the loving kindness meditation practice. The Pali word for it is called metta or metta practice. I'm going to resist the urge to talk about what the practice actually does because I kind of think it's best to allow it to work in your lives according to your own experience. No one's experience ever matches another's precisely. And the expectations can cloud our vision of what is actually going on in our own lives in a given moment. So let's try and avoid creating expectations. But once you've done the complete practice all the way through, you will find yourself practicing it when somebody cuts you off on the freeway. May she be healthy. May she be happy. May she be peaceful. May she be clear. Even if you have a grumpy note to the way you're expressing yourself, you'll find yourself doing the practice when your loved one is short-tempered or unkind. May he be healthy. May he be happy. May he be peaceful. May he be clear. You'll find yourself doing it when your boss is a jerk or when your parents are ailing. You'll find yourself doing it when your own children are being completely outrageously and uncompromisingly nasty to you. You'll find yourself practicing it towards yourself when your insight meditation practice becomes rigid or when fear invades your meditations. I will offer only this guidance and suggestion. If you find yourself in the practice of this meditation experiencing things that are confusing or difficult or uncomfortable, or if the practice seems to be having an unexpectedly adverse effect off the meditation cushion, and this goes for anybody on the call or anybody listening to the podcast, please give me a call or send me a note. Sometimes it helps to have someone to talk these issues through with. So that's the summary. What I propose to do now is to spend the next several minutes leading you through a guided loving-kindness meditation practice. If you've already got phrases that you're comfortable using, then certainly recite them in your mind as we proceed through the next several minutes. I'll lead the meditation using my phrases, and if you haven't got your own yet, you can certainly use mine. The one step that you need to make for now is to provisionally choose the persons you'll use for your loved one, the person you'll use for your neutral person, and the person you'll use for your adversary. So go ahead and choose those three persons. Take a moment, consider it. Loved one, neutral person, adversary. And then, if you're in a safe setting where you can concentrate, close your eyes. And if you're not, if you're listening to this as a podcast and you're driving down the road, please keep your eyes open. You can do this. But the amount of yourself that you devote to it really makes a difference in the outcome and in the intensity of the outcome. And so if you have the ability to do this when you have time to be still and calm, I'd recommend that you give it a try. Even if it's on an elliptical trainer. With the people chosen, close your eyes and concentrate. Think of yourself for a minute. and repeat in your mind, may I be healthy. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be clear. And then pause for a minute and see what arose in the mind. See if a sensation arose. See if resistance arose. Then take a deep breath in and repeat the phrases again. May I be healthy. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be clear. And pause for a moment. See what arises. See what mental sensations and physical sensations occur. Repeat the phrases again. May I be healthy. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be clear. And pause. And to repeat the phrases in your own mind for the next minute or two, and I'll prompt you a couple of times. But take the moment to repeat the phrases. May I be healthy. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be clear. And pause. Notice what's arisen. And one more time before we move to the next step. May I be healthy. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be clear. And take a breath. I'm a yoga teacher. I'm always into taking breaths. Take a deep breath. And allow the experience to settle for a moment. Without commenting on it, without trying to set it into stone, remember the identity of the loved one that you chose a moment ago. And now we'll repeat the practice for the self and for the loved one. And for me, my loved one is female, and so I'm going to use the pronoun she. If your loved one is male, you may want to use the pronoun he. If your loved one's a dog, you can choose whatever appropriate pronoun you want to use for that. But you always start with yourself. May I be healthy. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be clear. And you pause. Then you say, for the loved one, may she be healthy. May she be happy. May she be peaceful. May she be clear. Pause. May I be healthy. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be clear. And then for the loved one, may she be healthy. May she be happy. May she be peaceful. May she be clear. Then go through that cycle for yourself, repeating the phrases first for yourself and then for your loved one, and then I'll prompt you again. When you get to the end of the phrases, pause for a moment, take a breath. We'll repeat them together one more time at this stage. May I be healthy. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be clear. May she be healthy. May she be happy. May she be peaceful. May she be clear. Take a breath. Notice whatever has arisen so far, whether it's warmth or resistance, impatience, gratitude, whatever kind has come up. Notice what's come up. Take a breath in. And then recall the neutral person that you chose a moment ago. And we're only going to go through this a couple of times because I don't want the podcast to go on forever. But you start with yourself again. May I be healthy. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be clear. and for the loved one. May she be healthy. May she be happy. May she be peaceful. May she be clear. And then to the neutral person, may he be healthy. May he be happy. May he be peaceful. May he be clear. And notice the different quality now associated with repeating the phrases for somebody for whom you don't typically have any feelings at all. And notice the difference between saying the phrases for that person and for yourself, and the difference between saying the phrases for that person and for somebody whom you deeply love. And then repeat it again. May I be healthy. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be clear. And for the loved one, may she be healthy. May she be happy. May she be peaceful. May she be clear. And for the neutral person, may he be healthy. May he be happy. May he be peaceful. May he be clear. Take a moment, breathe in, and recite the phrases for yourself in your own mind. When you reach the end, take a breath, inhale, release it, exhale. And then, of course, we're going to add to that the adversary. But before we add the adversary, we do the phrases for ourselves, for our loved ones, and for the neutral person once again. We notice the difference in those experiences. May I be healthy. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be clear. And the loved one, may she be healthy, may she be happy, may she be peaceful, may she be clear. And the neutral person, may he be healthy, may he be happy, may he be peaceful, may he be clear. And for the adversary, may she be healthy, may she be happy. May she be peaceful. May she be clear. Let's do this whole cycle one more time. May I be healthy. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be clear. May the loved one, may she be healthy. May she be happy. May she be peaceful. May she be clear. The neutral person, may he be healthy. May he be happy. May he be peaceful. May he be clear. And the adversary, may she be healthy. May she be happy. May she be peaceful. May she be clear. And then pause for a moment, take a breath, and see what feelings have settled into your body at this point. Exhale, release the breath. When you reach the bottom of the exhale, draw the next breath in slowly and deliberately. And then when you get to the top of the inhale, pause just for a moment and then release it without pressing it out. Just allow it to drain out. And so now let's talk for a minute. What did you find as you engaged in this practice? What was your experience?
I find that when I'm doing the part for the adversary, I'm just saying words. But for lack of a better term, I could care less. It's like I'm faking it.
Yeah. Is that different than when you're saying the phrases for yourself or your loved one or your neutral person?
Yeah. The other ones, I have some emotion behind it. With the last one, it's just I'm saying it because that's the practice.
That's very normal, actually. For some people, you're actually two steps ahead of me when I first started doing this. Once I got over the formality of it and the contrivance, it seems like a contrived practice. So at first I started out resistant to the whole idea.
Uh-huh.
Once I let go of that level of resistance, I found that I could really see, do it in a heartfelt way for my loved one. I could even do it in a heartfelt way for my neutral person. When I did it for myself and when I did it for my adversary, it was completely mechanical. But what that tells you is that your internal orientation really has some resistance factors that are making it more difficult for you to experience a desire for the welfare of people that you view as your adversary. One of the strange things about this practice is that if you do it over time, what happens is exactly the same thing that happens through insight practice, but it enables us to see things that for one reason or another we just cannot see as we're doing the normal insight meditation practice. And one of those things that you see is that, oh, I am resistant. I'm holding something back in a circumstance that I hadn't noticed. So I'd encourage you to keep practicing. And if you don't force it, just repeat the phrases, allow whatever arises to arise, but be curious about it. Notice what's going on and see if this is a change over time.
Okay.
Okay. Greg or Laura, thoughts?
Well, this is Greg. You know, one of the things that I found the most challenging was to choose appropriate people, especially the neutral person and the adversary. I kept thinking maybe this person, then it occurred to me that that's just another manifestation of the same resistance.
Yes, it certainly can be an element of resistance. When you made the decision to choose nonetheless, how did the practice go for you, Greg?
Well, with the neutral person, it was, it wasn't exactly a neutral person as someone that I worked with, but not someone I, you know, have, but usually relationship is very professional.
Yeah.
But the adversary, that was more difficult. I guess I had the same experience. I sort of felt like I was saying the words.
One of the things that I had some challenge with at different points in my life was actually choosing an adversary. Because at first I thought, I don't have any enemies. And then I thought, that sounds like really implausible. There must be somebody who's an adversary. And I had to go through two or three levels of my own mind before I realized, oh, sure. This guy's an adversary, and oh, that woman's an adversary, and I just kind of had blocked myself out from even thinking about the possibility that I had adversaries in my life. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, oh, you know, because at first I chose a kind of a formal adversary. I'm a lawyer by training, a practice, and so I chose opposing counsel in a case. And then I got to thinking, I was going, yeah, technically he's my legal adversary, but we actually get along pretty well. And then I realized there were some people that pushed all of my buttons, made me angry, that are people I'd always find myself getting angry when I was talking with them, or, hey, even though these people are my friends, they're also my adversaries. And in some regards, they're my enemies. They're the ones for whom I have ill will feelings, anger, and so sometimes just choosing the people can be a really interesting part of the insight meditation process. So I appreciate you sharing that, Greg. Laura, are you still with us?
I am.
You've practiced this before.
I have. I actually started practicing it, I think, a couple years ago. And I guess I do the practice slightly different. And okay. I focus on a particular person, whether it be the adversary, and I don't go back and forth. And that's only because I forget where I'm at in the rotation. So I am like you, Sean, where I found not only was it more mechanical for the adversary, but also for myself. I felt like giving myself loving kindness, seemed either a little bit vain or ridiculous. I'm not really sure which one it was, but you know, I certainly met up with those resistances that you have, and that I would say for at least the first 6 months.
Isn't that amazing? What shifted after that first 6 month period?
I was in the middle of a meditation for loving kindness meditation towards the adversary. And I just was diligent with the practice. I chose the same adversary every time. And then finally was able to, I guess, break through that wall of resistance, and found myself crying, and at least in a manner that I could let go of the grief that that adversary had caused.
Wow. Like as you mentioned, Laura, my first experience with this practice, as I was on my elliptical training machine, was feeling of complete artificiality. I kept thinking, first I started to practice, thought, okay, mechanical, may I be healthy, may I be happy, may I be peaceful, may I be clear, may I be healthy, may I be happy, may I be peaceful, may I be clear, blah, 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 blah. And I thought, this is stupid. And then I started to get angry. Why am I doing this? Who invented this stupid practice? What on earth? Do I have to keep doing it for myself? And then at about day three, I caught myself thinking, look how resistant you are, Sean, to even thinking about yourself in terms of loving kindness. What's that about? And that was enough of a hook to keep me paying attention. I thought, well, maybe there's something I have to learn. But it was still mechanical when I said the phrases for myself. But I started to be curious to see what arose. And for me, most of what arose was resistance during the first person. The loving person was easy for a while, and then I had to change the loving person because my own internal orientation started to shift. And I realized that I could have chosen a better person to start with, but so what? So I made the change there. The neutral person has always been the difficult one for me, and has always truly been difficult because I tend to space out when it comes to neutral people. I couldn't, you know, I'm terrible with names of people for whom I feel generally pretty neutral feelings. I started to realize, oh, wait. And what I found was that even though I do the practice wasn't remarkable in and of itself when I was doing it for a neutral person. What I did discover during the week that I devoted to the neutral person was that I suddenly became aware of all the neutral people in my life. I'd be walking down the street going, oh, that's a neutral person right there. I don't know who that person is. I don't feel ill will. I don't feel warmth towards him. He's a neutral person. And it's easy to think about that with other drivers of other cars. But then I started to notice that there were people who've been in my life for a long time about whom I felt relatively neutral. And I thought that was kind of interesting. And then as you said, Laura, then I reached the adversary and I found myself, as Ken and Greg both expressed as well, going completely mechanical. May he be healthy. May he be happy. May he be peaceful. May he be clear. And it wasn't that I felt adversity toward him. I just felt mechanical. It's like I'm doing this practice because I'm supposed to do this practice. And it wasn't actually until months after I had begun this practice that I started to find the softening. And for me, the first softening for an adversary came on the freeway as a guy cut me off. I go from calm to instantly furious when somebody does that. I don't know why, but that's what my disposition is. And I found myself thinking, may he be healthy, may he be happy, may he be peaceful, may he be clear. And I kind of busted out laughing when I said these phrases as nastily as I possibly could toward an adversary. And I thought, oh, I just chose, or I didn't choose, but I just went through the internal process that shifted me from equanimity to animosity. And I just discovered that I can switch back pretty readily. And it all has to do with trying to extend some loving kindness toward this person who just cut me off. And then I actually had to go through an imaginative process and create a story about that person before I could really bring myself to let it go. But I also found that happening. I found myself imagining, oh, maybe he's late to work and he's been late 3 days in a row and this is his fourth day and he doesn't want to have his boss chew him out yet again. Or maybe he's on the phone talking to his daughter who's in college and she's going through some crisis and he's not really paying attention right now to the road. Or maybe he's driving off to save somebody's life and he's a doctor in the hospital. And I started coming up with 1,000 different stories, and I started to realize that the feelings I had toward him didn't have to be all that different than the feelings I had toward myself or my loved one. Other thoughts before we move on?
What makes you have to switch people? You keep talking about an internal shift. Is that just something we each experience as you do this longer and longer?
Yeah, it's not something that you can cause to happen. It's something that happens on its own. And rather than trying to press yourself into changing something, whenever I press myself into changing something, I'm really not changing anything except the wrapping paper around whatever's already in the box. At the end of each cycle, pause, think, you know, do I feel loving kindness? And if not, let me try this again. May he be healthy. May he be happy. May he be peaceful. May he be clear. Just repeating those phrases like them for the person starts to change the way you experience that person the next time that person arises in your awareness. Just as every single action you take, every intention you formulate, every act that you take and engage in is karma. It creates karma. Part of the karma that you create when you repeat these phrases for somebody is that the next time you think of that person, your mind is going to have this particular pathway enabled. It's going to say, oh, yes, that person is my adversary, and on this occasion he made me really angry. But the most recent experience I had with that adversary was thinking, may he be healthy, may he be happy, may he be peaceful, may he be clear. And you start to accrete new karma to the old karma that you've already developed for the person. And ultimately, this practice changes you. You know, there are people who think that it also changes the other person, and I leave that for those who find that to be a useful belief. I don't disagree with it, but it's not something that I focus on particularly. Most of my experience is that this changes the way I experience other people, and as it changes those experiences, it changes the insights that I have about myself and what it means to be a person and an individual. So, no, you don't need to change. You don't need to force anything. You just keep doing the practice and trusting the practice. There are a whole lot of things in Buddhist practice that require faith. This is one of them. And the faith isn't a belief practice. It's just enough faith to say, I'm going to give this a try, even though I don't see how it's going to work.
I think it's a shaky slope to be on when you – slippery slope, I should say, to be on when you think that the practice itself would change the other person in some manner. I mean, energetically, I understand where the Buddhist is coming from with that. But at the same time, as a human being, I think if you meditate from the mindset of expecting somebody else to change and they don't, then you're going to be sorely disappointed.
Bravo.
That makes sense.
So I try to focus on changing my own karma, like you said, Sean. It does eventually, you know, when you talk about neurons that fire together, wire together, eventually you skip a step where you don't have to think the loving kindness meditation all the way through before you have the compassionate thought towards your adversary.
If you pick an adversary that you interact with regularly, has it changed the way you behave toward that person over time?
For me, it has. I would say I assume that they are not doing something to directly antagonize me, but, you know, it's some other cause. That thought enters before the reactive thought.
I think that's a really good way of explaining it. One of the things that happens for me is that what I discover is that when I experience resistance towards another person, one of the first things that happens is my mind starts to narrow the list of possibilities that it's willing to consider. And all of the considerations that apply automatically to my loved ones I discovered that those considerations, those possibilities, all of those, that range of, oh, you know, maybe this was going on, maybe that was going on, even if this person did this on purpose, I still love them. All of that range of possibilities was completely gone for my adversary. And all I had left was, may he be healthy, may he be happy, may he be peaceful, may he be clear. And then I started to realize, wait a minute, part of the reason I chose this person as an adversary is because I experienced that narrowing of possibilities when I encountered that person. You can kind of pursue whys forever without ever getting necessarily to the bottom of them, but it was a real revelation to me to realize that I wasn't affording that person the same kindness of thought, kindness of emotion, kindness and generosity of attention that I give to my loved ones. And I started to realize that the reason he's my adversary is because I've made him my adversary. Not saying that my actions or my thought pattern is going to change the way he conducts himself in the world, but I realized that he was, I mean, there are a lot of people that I didn't get along with or that I find, whose actions I find self-defeating and problematic, who aren't my adversaries at all. Sometimes I feel bad for them. Sometimes I sympathize with them. Sometimes I go, yeah, that's me too. But they're not my adversaries. The people who are my real adversaries required a decision, and maybe not an overt conscious decision, but they required an investment of emotion by me. And part of that investment of emotion was that I artificially narrowed and constricted the range of potential possibilities that I was willing to credit that person with. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting insight.
I hope this isn't too much of a tangent, but now, when I try to do this practice, I've chosen the phrase free from suffering, may be free from suffering. To me, clear, I don't understand that either same, well, partly there's some internal resistance on my part to that phrase, because I think either of an old Barney Miller episode or a similar era where, you know, someone, a wide-eyed, not quite all there woman saying, are you clear?
Well, you totally have to adapt the phrases to what works for you. Clear for me stands for a very different concept, but if that's the concept that arises when you use the word clear, don't ever use the word clear. Use a different phrase.
Yes, free from suffering seems to work for me, except for the rhythm.
I will note that different circumstances can sometimes require a little bit of fine-tuning of the phrases, but I encourage you to, once you pick the phrases, to stick with them. But I noticed when I was with my mother as she was dying, I could no longer say, may you be healthy. Because, frankly, it's not that there isn't a way to interpret the word healthy that is consistent with a person dying. I think that there totally is. But because I'd invested the word healthy with so much physical well-being, physical development, physical positive experience, because I'd invested that word so heavily with that concept, I couldn't use it for my mother. And so I actually shortened phrases to three phrases. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be clear. But, you know, circumstance requires a little bit of adjustment for these things. I'd like to maybe wind up today's discussion by reading something that maybe I've already shared with each of you before. If I have, I apologize. If people in the podcast community have heard this too, then maybe it's like hearing the phrases over again. But this is a poem that I thought was pretty when I first heard it, but before I started the loving kindness meditation practice. But after I started the practice, I found this poem increasingly meaningful, because I started to recognize that there didn't need to be a difference between the sensation I felt toward myself, sensation I felt towards my loved one, the sensation I felt towards the neutral person, the sensation I felt towards my adversary. The poem is by Thich Nhat Hanh, the Zen meditation master, and it's called Call Me By My True Names. Do not say that I'll depart tomorrow, because even today I still arrive. Look deeply. I arrive in each second, to be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird with wings still fragile, learning to sing in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower. to be a jewel hiding itself in a stone. I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, in order to fear and to hope. The rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of all that are alive. I am the mayfly metamorphosing on the surface of the river, and I am the bird which, when spring comes, arrives in time to eat the mayfly. I am the frog swimming happily in the clear pond, and I am also the grass snake who, approaching in silence, feeds itself on the frog. I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks, and I am the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the pirate, my heart yet not yet capable of seeing and loving. I am a member of the Politburo with plenty of power in my hands, and I am the man who has to pay his debt of blood to my people, dying slowly in a forced labor camp. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom in all walks of life. My pain is like a river of tears, so full it fills the four oceans. Please call me by my true names, so I can hear all my cries and laughs at once, so I can see that my joy and pain are one. Please call me by my true names, so I can wake up, and so the door of my heart can be left open, the door of compassion. That was by Thich Nhat Hanh, Call Me By My True Names. My friends, once again, I'm delighted to have had the opportunity to spend this hour with you. Thank you so much for sharing your lives with me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
Blessings. I look forward to talking with you again. The next Dharma talk will be coming up soon, and it's going to be at Debbie Perez's request. We'll be talking about the five skandhas and the role that they play in Buddhist practice and the definition of the self. So I look forward to talking with you again.